Hello, this is Wendy Bauer with the Decatur Herald and Review for February 15th, 2016. We're going to begin today's reading on the front page with the article headlined, World War II Gratitude Continues, subtitled, World War II Flyer's Granddaughter Returns to France for Honors. This is an article written by Huey Freeman, a staff writer for the Herald and Review, from Blue Mound. While serving as a bombardier with the 8th Air Force, Lieutenant Robert Peck Wilcox of Blue Mound was shot down over France. A French family hid him from the Germans for more than 8 months, believed to be the longest any American was protected from the Nazis in occupied France. That was more than 70 years ago. But the French people who live in the region where Wilcox was hidden, in the wine region near Bordeaux, have not forgotten him, nor the brave people who risked their lives to rescue him. As part of the festivities to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the victorious end to World War II, a ceremony was held in the tiny southwestern town of Saint-Simon-de-Pelouet in December to honor Wilcox and his French benefactors. Wilcox, who served as a rural mail carrier in Blue Mound after the war for 23 years, died in 1999. When the French people reached out to his family to send representatives from across the ocean for the ceremony, it was fitting that his granddaughter, Carrie Foster, decided to make the trip. Foster, who grew up down the road from her grandfather and was close to him, was contacted via Facebook in November by an English woman living in France who was hired to try to reach the aviator's family. I was a little skeptical, Foster said, adding that the contact was facilitated because she posted the story of her grandfather's adventure on the social media site. The ceremony was scheduled to take place just a few weeks later. Foster tried to persuade some of her family members to join her, but they were busy, so she made her first overseas journey by herself. It was just such short notice, but there was no stopping me, said Foster, who has been fascinated by her grandfather's amazing story for as long as she can remember. She was persuaded to make the trip partly because she had recently survived a motorcycle accident in which her friend was killed and she was incapacitated for most of the summer. That made me feel like I should go, Foster said. In addition to her connection with her grandfather, whose memory she serves by keeping his diaries and newspaper clippings of his return visits to France, Foster has become friends with French people who were acquainted with Wilcox. Bernard Bollinger, who has written articles on the war, visited Blue Mound in October with his wife Dominique and two grandchildren. They put French flags on my grandparents' graves, Foster said. They're in the Hall Cemetery in Blue Mound, right behind our house. So when the Bollingers heard about the ceremony, they offered to host Foster during her visit. They met her at the Bordeaux airport December 16th. They took me sightseeing every day, Foster said, adding she finally got to see for herself the sights she had heard so much about from her grandfather. They took me on the route he walked before he was hidden. They showed me where my grandfather bailed out and landed. She got to see the distillery where Wilcox hid the first night he was on the ground. The next night he came upon Frederick, a teen who was on a bicycle. Frederick took him home and told his mom and dad. Here is an American. They decided to hide him. Wilcox was kept mostly in an attic over a stable. No one else in the little village knew he was there, Foster said, adding that her grandfather was a farmer just like the people who hid him. Besides being hidden the longest period of time, it is possible Wilcox broke the record for showing gratitude and staying in touch with his French benefactors. He returned to France to visit Monsieur and Mademoiselle Nadeau in 1967, 77, 80, and 83. My grandfather sent them numerous family photos over the years, Foster said. On the day of the ceremony, December 19th, Foster was driven in a procession in a restored U.S. Army mail van, apparently left over from the days when soldiers swarmed through France en route to Germany. I was in awe, Foster said, at the coincidence of riding in a postal vehicle as her grandfather did for so many years. The Nadeau family, including Frederick, were no longer alive. Foster was moved to see the graves of the people who saved her grandfather. The U.S. consul gave 1,000 euros to redo the graves of the Nadeau family, she said. The graves were in disrepair. Foster met an 85-year-old woman named Helen, who lived next door to the Nadeaus. She said that she and her husband were friends with Foster's grandfather. During his visits to France, he would frequent their grocery store and buy gum from them. He wrote them constantly, two or three times a month, to different people, Foster said. Wilcox had learned some French during his stay at the Nadeau farm. He would write his letters in French, using the dictionary. The people who attended the ceremony expressed their gratitude for what the Americans did to liberate their country. Just because I was his granddaughter, I was treated like a queen, Foster said. The plane in which Wilcox flew on December 31, 1943, was never recovered. After anti-aircraft flak opened a hole in its nose and caused an engine fire, the crew bailed out and the plane crashed into the ocean. Wilcox had dropped the bombs as they approached their target, the Cognac Airport. One of the greatest gifts Foster received was a collection of 7 pieces of an American plane recently recovered in the area, which was shot down during the same mission as Wilcox's B-17 bomber. It was given to her by Michel Souris, a man who has found more than 6,000 pieces of that plane through his determination to unearth and preserve history. A lot of people in the area are interested in the history of what the Americans were doing there, Foster said. She had many unforgettable experiences in France, including visiting the room where her grandfather had been hidden. The trip was a magnificent adventure, meeting so many people who let her know that Americans, especially her grandfather, were important to them. She was proud to represent Peck Wilcox and the men who flew with him to liberate Europe. That was one of the biggest honors I ever had, she said. Also from the front page, from Springfield, budget address stakes high as Illinois struggles. Subtitled Rauner's Budget Address Faces Grim Situation by Dan Petrella, the Herald and Review Springfield Bureau Chief. 1 week after President Barack Obama called for bipartisan compromise in a speech before the Illinois General Assembly, Governor Bruce Rauner on Wednesday will address that still steeply divided body about his plan for next year's state budget. The first-term Republican's second budget address comes as he and the Democrats who control the legislature remain deadlocked over the budget for the current fiscal year, which began July 1st. Despite impending layoffs at public universities, disruption of social services across Illinois, and warnings that the state is digging itself billions of dollars deeper into debt due to declining revenue and court-mandated spending, there is no sign of a resolution. Democrats say Rauner continues to insist on passing portions of his union-weakening turnaround agenda before he'll agree to tax increases to balance the budget. The governor said that whereas he and fellow Republicans are seeking structural reforms that would increase revenue by growing the economy, Democrats offer only tax hikes and budget cuts. One thing on which lawmakers from both parties can agree is that while state law requires the governor to present his budget plan for next year, Rauner's speech needs to focus on resolving the current budget impasse as well. What I would like to hear is a focus on solving the problem this fiscal year, said State Senator Andy Menar, a Bunker Hill Democrat who serves on Senate Appropriations Committees. We should continue to work on the current fiscal year because next fiscal year's budget framework isn't going to come together without addressing the problem in the current fiscal year. State Rep. Dan Brady, a Bloomington Republican who serves on the House Budget Oversight Committee, said Rauner may offer a 2-year plan that includes granting him authority to move money around within this year's budget to cover shortfalls in areas that aren't protected by the courts, such as higher education. Because of the quicksand that we're in, the governor is going to need a lifeline extended to him from the General Assembly. Democrats and Republicans allowing him the authority to do budget transfers that none of us like, Brady said. But it's going to have to be done if we're going to try and have some form of a budget yet in this fiscal year. Although a similar solution was used to plug holes in last year's budget after a temporary state income tax increase was allowed to partially roll back, Democrats appear unlikely to go along again this year. Another issue on which there seems to be some consensus inside and outside state government is that new revenue will be needed to put the state on firmer financial footing. In a report released Thursday, the Chicago-based Civic Federation, a nonpartisan budget watchdog, recommends raising personal and corporate income tax rates back to their pre-rollback levels of 5% and 7%, taxing non-Social Security retirement income, expanding the sales tax to services, and temporarily removing the sales tax exemption for food and over-the-counter medicine, among other recommendations. These increases should be coupled with spending cuts aimed at paying down the state's unpaid bills and other changes to deal with ballooning pension costs, according to the report. There is nothing politically attractive, there is nothing easy about what the state of Illinois faces, said Lawrence Massal, the organization's president. Ralph Martier, executive director of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, said his organization has been making similar revenue recommendations for years. If you don't do those things, you can't solve your problem, Martier said, and that's not ideological, that's math. The Responsible Budget Coalition, a group of more than 250 social service agencies, labor unions, and other organizations across the state, also is urging the state to choose revenue. We want to hear the governor say his number one priority is a budget that invests in families and communities and that he won't use them as leverage for his non-budget agenda, coalition spokesman Neil Waltmeyer said. State Representative Mike Smitty, a Hillsdale Democrat, said that what he doesn't want to hear Wednesday is another recitation of Rauner's turnaround agenda. If he continues to bring out the issues time and time again, I think it's going to be very difficult for the state, Smitty said. And from today's paper, front page, Tony Reed, the Herald Review staff writer, Snow Slickens Area Traveling. Subtitled, Multiple Crashes Stem from Up to 4 Inches in Central Illinois. From Decatur, love it or hate it, Mother Nature's Valentine's Day gift to Central Illinois was a blowing white bouquet of snow. Sunday's accumulation ranged up to 4 inches in some parts, more toward Lincoln and Springfield, with the Decatur area picking up about 3 inches. Illinois State Police reported multiple crashes in vehicles in ditches and dealt with dozens of collisions on roads ranging from icy interstates to snow-packed county back roads. Drivers were warned to use extreme caution if they had to travel. Other people with no particular place to go made the most of it. Cross-country skiers and one couple clad in snowshoes hit the trails around Rock Springs Nature Center. Macon County Conservation District worker Ethan Snively was busy, meanwhile, blasting snow away from the Nature Center's building using a backpack leaf blower. It's not designed for blowing snow, but on ice, powdery snow, it works. On nice, powdery snow, it works well, Snively said. That nice and powdery snow became the problem for Macon County snowplow crews as wind gusts to 25 miles per hour easily draped the snow over rural roads in heavy drifts. They're looking very white right now, said Macon County Highway Engineer Bruce Bird when asked about the appearance of county roads early Sunday afternoon. We've got snowplow crews out and they're keeping up with what's out there. It's just that half an hour after they've gone through, it looks like no one had been there to touch the road at all, Bird added. He said the snowfall in the county Sunday appeared to be double some early projections. But he said his crews were likely to make better progress after 6 p.m. when the snow was due to fade out. The National Weather Service in Lincoln, which issued a winter weather advisory for Sunday and described the snow as causing havoc on highways, said light snow showers and patchy freezing drizzle were expected overnight into today. But the effects would be short-lived, as temperatures today were due to hit a high of 36. There's a 50% chance that up to an inch of snow could then return Monday night into Tuesday, but a warming trend will reach a high of 40 degrees Tuesday afternoon and soon melt it all. Friday's high is predicted to reach close to an unseasonal 60 degrees, with low to mid-50s the high on Saturday. Meteorologist Kirk Hudel said the weather is going from unseasonal low temperatures that preceded Sunday's snow to unseasonal highs. We're finally getting out of this Arctic air mass that has been with us, added Hudel. Our normal highs are in the upper 30s for this time of year, and now, if you're heading to St. Louis Friday, you're looking at 68 degrees for a high. The meteorologist said Sunday's bout of snow, part of a widespread storm that caused severe problems in other parts of the country, still hasn't lifted our annual snowfall to normal levels. We're still running a few inches below normal for this time of year, he explained. Tony Reed also brings an article from Iliopolis, titled Whistle While He Works, subtitled Iliopolis Man Works to Save Whistle History. Billy Irvin can't whistle up the wind, but he knows how to sound out yesterday. He is a collector and restorer of factory whistles, those steam-powered rooftop instruments that called the faithful to work for generations when reliable watches weren't always within reach of everyone. From the late Victorian period up through the 1950s, the brass and bronze whistles provided the soundtrack of working-class lives. They signaled shift changes and lunch, and mercifully, time to go home. They were your worst enemy in the morning and your best friend in the afternoon, you know, says Irvin, 35, who lives in the country near Iliopolis. But often running on 150 pounds per square inch, 150 pounds per square inch of steam pressure and generating more than 100 decibels easily, it wasn't just the workers who took notice. Friends, Romans, and countrymen outside the factory gates couldn't help but lend them their ears, too, which is why whistles became the tweets and emails of their age, able to signal major events instantly. Irvin has just finished a month-long project to restore former Mueller Water Products, Inc. Decatur factory whistle to its bronze glory. It now stands a gleaming but silent sentinel at the front entrance of the Hieronymus Mueller Museum and holds the memory of having been blasted to mark the end of World War I at 11 a.m. on November 11, 1918. Decatur's Review newspaper was entrusted with the job of actually confirming that the mass bloodbath in the war to end all wars had finally ceased. The Review will notify the Mueller factory, and the whistle will be sounded. All the other whistles in the city will then fall in the chorus, according to a news clipping from the time, anticipating the grand event. Now, many of those factories of a century ago lie buried in the sound garden of history, along with their whistles. Irvin, a maintenance welder at Decatur's Caterpillar Inc. plant, is part of a small nationwide fraternity of whistle fans who hunt their quarry amid abandoned buildings and internet sales. Before the personal computer, searching was kind of a crapshoot, Irvin says. The internet has made it 1,000 times easier. The master of a home workshop armed with a vast 1927 engine lathe, Irvin has the means and the skills to manufacture parts from raw brass and metal to save the whistles he finds. He had to make parts to fix the Mueller whistle and did it all for free, an intense labor of love. I appreciate what the Mueller Museum is doing for the community by preserving the past, he says. I think that is pretty important. What are the chances of a whistle expert walking into the museum one day, as Irvin did, and just happening to ask if they had the old factory whistle? It was stored in the basement, and then offering to fix it. Laura Jarre, assistant museum director, is a big believer in the soundness of fate. It's serendipity. We seem to get lucky over here in ways that we can't often believe, she says. And oh, what an amazing job Mr. Irvin did with our whistle, which would have been installed at the factory before 1900. You really need to come see it. Irvin's own collection runs to 27 gleaming items, ranging from 2.5-inch tall train cab whistles to 2-foot-long factory monsters in gleaming brass and bronze. One circa 1918 specimen was saved from an old Pennsylvania Railroad workshop in Mingo Junction, Pennsylvania. This whistle sits outside his home and is connected to a compressed air supply and lets rip with a 7-second blast every day at 5 o'clock p.m. There are no neighbors nearby, which is just as well, as Irvin says he's tested out the system and can still hear it pretty plain from 4 miles away. Another of his whistles used to crown a psychiatric hospital in Buffalo, New York, and is a 24-inch column of bronze with a gaping, red-painted mouth. It would signal shift changes, but also had a darker use. It would be blown if there was an escape, Irvin says. The whistle resurrection specialist worries that what's escaped us now is the whole bustling industrial era, when factory whistles blasted forth their confident notes that told of lots of middle-class jobs chasing the American dream. For such a simple item, there was so much behind whistles and what they kind of represented, he says. An entire town could take pride in a busy factory. But not every whistle story has to end on a sad note. Irvin tells of a steam whistle that graced a former International Harvester plant in Canton that had been part of the soundscape of daily life there for generations. The remains of the hulking factory, which died in the 1980s, caught fire in 1997, but the then mayor ordered that the whistle, known as Big Toot, be salvaged. And when a company called Cook Polymer Technology came along to build its new plant on the old harvester site, a working Big Toot was enshrined on the roof to thunderous applause on March 2, 2015. It now sounds daily at 8 a.m., noon, and 5 p.m., and March 2 is known by official proclamation as Big Toot Day, in honor of the generations that labored in the harvester factory. A whistle that's got to go home early, Irvin says. That's neat. And then from the local pages by Sharon Barraclough for the Herald and Review. Shelby County considers fine for ignoring flood signs requiring rescue. Shelby County drivers who ignore closed signs on flooded roads could be liable for fines if they have to be rescued from their vehicle in high water. The Shelby County Dive Team asked the Shelby County Board last week to consider an ordinance charging up to $1,000 for rescuing a person and $500 for moving a vehicle trapped in high water on a marked flooded road. In the last 12 months, 90% of our calls have been due to flooded roadways, and in most cases, those roads are marked, Dive Team Commander Austin Pritchard said. Pritchard said shallow water road rescues can cause damage to dive team equipment, including an inflatable boat that has been damaged on fence posts and debris. It costs $3,000 to replace that boat, he said. These calls are hard on our equipment and we simply can't afford it. The dive team has an annual budget of $16,000. Volunteers for the team require $3,000 in equipment and $500 in training to become a team member. The proposed ordinance also calls for fines if the dive team is required to move debris resulting from an accident. County board members said they wanted more information before considering the ordinance request. I'd like to know who is responsible for removing debris on the road after a flood, said board member Joe Woodall. I think we need to clarify that. Shelby County State's Attorney Gina Vonderhyde said the new ordinance was an option for the county. It has to be the same enforceability as any other ordinance, she said. The board agreed to reconsider the proposal in March after Shelby County Engineer Alan Spessard, whose department is responsible for the roads, has a chance to review it. The dive team is just trying to do the best we can to keep our equipment in good working condition and do the job we volunteered to do, Pritchard said. And from Mattoon, Backpack gives musical buzz. A tool used normally by DJs to feel intense bass without doing long-term hearing damage will now be used by the deaf and hard of hearing at Williams Elementary School to experience music in a different way. With a grant from Illinois Alliance of Administrators of Special Education, these Eastern Illinois Area of Special Education deaf and hard of hearing students will be able to experience and follow along with music in class. They will be strapping on a backpack, sub-pack, that produces heavy, deep vibrations that correlate with the music that is being played. We were having some problems with students in the music class not feeling connected, said Debbie Rotremel, EIASE Associate Director. The students with hearing issues were less able to join in, Rotremel said. Alex Murrell, EIASE teacher, said they would sometimes have the students put their hand against the speaker as it played music, but it was not really a fluid way of giving the students the experience of music. The teachers talked to me about that and wondered if I could come up with any ideas. So I started doing some research, and I found what is called sub-pack, Rotremel said. At a frequency of 5 to 130 hertz, these students will be using packs to feel the music, to follow along and stay caught up with the class. The backpack produces a similar experience to that of shaking when music is loud. Vivian Ritchie signed that it was similar to when a car starts and the music is loud, causing the car to vibrate. This gives them that experience so that they can make that connection to music, Rotremel said. When putting on the backpack, many of the students' faces lit up at having a tangible way of expressing music. In some of the first tests of the equipment, many of the students would even dance with songs like Watch Me, Whip Nay Nay. It's awesome, Jaden Adams of Shelbyville said. Jaden said it was difficult to concentrate on what the instructor would say as well as listen to the music being played. Only two packs have been purchased for the students, but Rotremel said she would like to get more in order for everyone in the class to experience it at one time. It just provides them another outlet to expand their knowledge and expand what they are learning, she said. We talk about music, we refer to music, it is a big part of our lives, and it is something they don't understand because they don't experience it. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, February 15th, 2016. Please stay tuned.